If a small flock of cartoon bluebirds didn't help you get dressed this morning, that just means you haven't yet listened to Fine Tuning with Jim Hill and Drew Taylor. No, the black dress slacks, please. Thank you. And now, Jim Hill.
Welcome to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I'm Drew's co-host, entertainment writer Jim Hill, and he and I are recording this on Friday, April 19th, 2019. As we were getting ready to record the show today, Disney broke news about Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway, right?
Yeah, it's coming to Disneyland Resort in 2022. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there was an interesting little tidbit that was tucked away in this announcement, and it explains why they made the announcement on Friday. Mm-hmm. Which is that the Walt Disney World version is not going to open until spring 2020, when it was supposed to open this year. And it's in all of the Disney's Hollywood Studios 30th promotional materials, too.
Yeah. Oh, to hell with it. I'm just going to tell this story. Yes, we've been hearing that this thing was delayed. And evidently, there are some construction-related issues. There are some manpower-related issues, but there's another thing here, Drew. Do you remember when Mickey's Toontown opened at Disneyland back in 1993? And then 1 year later, we saw Roger Rabbit's Cartoon Spin open in this same section of the park. Supposedly, Roger Rabbit was completed. It was ready on time. It could have opened the exact same day as Mickey's Toontown. But the thinking was that, what are we going to do for year two? How are we going to get people to come back after they've tried this land? And it's like, okay, let's hold back this ride. So they basically mothballed it for a year. Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway, if they get past a lot of the construction issues, it could be open as early as holiday 2019.
Okay.
But there's also some thoughts, you know, to the effect of the entire world is going to start coming to this theme park in August once Galaxy's Edge opens. And why create yet another reason for the whole world to come to this park to try the, you know, the first ride through with Mickey and Minnie and all the amazing effects that you'll be able to see in this thing? So it's like, let's push this back.
So you're saying it could be open at the end of the year, but they're choosing perhaps to keep it under wraps.
I think at this point, the couple of conversations that I've had about this, it's one thing to go from a December, January opening to a spring.
Right.
The spring decision is supposedly deliberate. The upside is, don't be surprised if in, say, the February, March, April window, you see Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway suddenly pop open for soft openings. They're going to have to anticipate, how do we handle the crowds for this? How do we do the queuing and all that? So this is a more complex situation than just, we're having tech problems, we're having trouble getting enough construction workers, you know, all that sort of thing. There's some other stuff going on here.
So is my one of my favorite shops, the Gag mm-hmm. Factory, is that remaining?
Yes, that's safe. The Downtown Toontown is hands off. In fact, they made a very, very deliberate choice about the positioning of this building, because if you were to fly over the park in a helicopter and look down when construction is complete, in theory, you could walk out the back door of Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway and inside of a minute be inside of Galaxy's Edge. They're going to be that close to one another.
Oh, that's interesting.
But if you're a guest, you have to walk the better part of a mile, even from Galaxy's Edge, the entrance at the top of Big Thunder Trail, through Fantasyland, up through Small World Plaza, under the berm, through Toontown, all the way back. And that's deliberately being done and set up that way, Drew, to bleed people off.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, out of Black Spire Outpost.
Well, that's interesting, too, considering that for a long time, people had sort of marked Toontown as a potential spot for Galaxy's Edge.
They had. And thank goodness, Paul Felix, right? He's the gentleman who did the brand new set of Mickey shorts.
Paul Ruddish.
Okay, yeah. My mistake. But yeah, those shorts, in a lot of ways, saved Mickey's Toontown because, you know, Mickey had this huge resurgence in popularity. And it's kind of ironic, you're going to walk by the bland corporate Mickey's home, you know, that was created back in 80, you know, for 83, and then go experience this crazy ride with the Reddish take on Mickey, which has just been great fun since day one.
Well, is there ever any, is there ever a chance that they'll ever do another Roger Rabbit ride, or is that, or the rights and everything so naughty that they could never untangle it for another attraction?
Paul Rubens has been out there doing some press out ahead of Galaxy's Edge, you know, because he's, you know, they're retooling Rex. And
did you see that I held the Rex Bluetooth speaker at Star Wars Celebration? The no! number one. Yeah.
No. Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, he can drive around, and he actually interrupts your music with his little catchphrases. It's pretty cute.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, 20 recordings from Paul Rubens in this little droid. Anyway.
That's so cool. But when you know Paul's history with Roger Rabbit, and some of this has to do with how well Welcome to
Marwin.
Marwin yeah. did. Robert Zemeckis is kind of looking for a hit now because it's been a while. Evidently, there have been some new Roger Rabbit related conversations. So,
Interesting.
The downside of that, though, is this is still a Disney / Amblin thing, and a lot of clocks have to chime at the exact same time for this thing to work. But evidently, Zemeckis himself is sort of trying to get this to happen again. And remember, you know, what was it? Like, you know, within the past 4 or 5 years, he's talked about there is a script. We all seem to like it. But it's just, it's getting things to line up the right way. And given that Mary Poppins Returns didn't really do the numbers that Disney had hoped, likewise Tron Legacy, what are the chances that, hey, yeah, let's do another sequel for a movie we made back in, what, 1988? I don't know if I would get all that excited about this.
Well, and in December, I asked him, asked Robert Zemeckis, and I said, would you ever want to return to that world? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, look, there's a really good script at Disney for a sequel, but I don't think it's on their agenda. There are no princesses in it.
You know what that says to me? It says, you know, I bet there was a rewrite, you know, after yeah. Marwin. And it's like, can we get Elsa into this? How you know, Anna and Elsa have to help Roger, you know, maybe,
right.
maybe they're helping him move his house. I don't know.
Yeah. And then he said about Toontown, like Toontown because it makes you nervous. When you're in Toontown, I get anxious because it's kind of nuts. I think they really captured the thing that was the essence of Toontown from the movie. It's almost like at certain points you say, I've got to get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
See, again, this is a guy who's still thinking about this world. And
yeah.
But like I said, on the heels of Tron Legacy and Mary Poppins Returns, though that said, just the other day I had somebody telling me that they were kind of surprised that as part of the big Disney Plus Investors Day presentation, that they didn't mention that Tron 3 is potentially being considered for, I guess, year 2 of Disney Plus.
Right. Yeah. I haven't heard anything on that front, but I would not be surprised if that happens. Yeah, but it was weird that it was excluded.
When you talk with folks on the Disney Plus side, they talk about how the movies are going to be made for Disney Plus. They're not blockbuster budget movies. They made the comparison to, they wanted them to be sort of those live action comedies. Like, for example, The Santa Claus. It's really not a coincidence that, you know, one of the projects that's coming out through Disney Plus is, what is it, Noelle?
Noelle, yeah.
Yeah, about Santa's daughter. And I guess that's the reason why they're talking about doing Tron 3 through Disney Plus, because it turns out this is the affordable one.
Yeah.
Because the gimmick is that the things from the virtual world come into our world.
Yes.
So, correct. You know, you're not spending all this money on CG. People are riding light cycles and that sort of thing out in the real world. And didn't they get like within inches of doing this in Vancouver?
I mean, it was ready to go. And I don't know what exactly turned them off from it, but yeah, it was a go movie. Mm-hmm. And from what I was told, it was almost like their bid to create a kind of Marvel-type world within the Tron world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure they'll circle back. If they have a script that everybody signed off on already, and, you know, I could definitely see it happening.
Speaking of the Disney Plus presentation, Did you see the Simpsons clip they used?
That was so good. It was so funny because I was walking around Celebration mm-hmm. as the investors meeting was going on. So I had to kind of like peel off from the floor and watch some of the stuff. But yeah, it was really great. Really cute.
I love the whole Homer. I welcome my new corporate overlords. You know, the lovely callback to the Kent Brockman from Deep Space Homer. I, for one, welcome our new insect overlords. Okay, the downside of having corporate overlords is they make decisions for you. And did you see this thing where, what was it, the Mouse Guard 2 weeks out from the start of production got shut down by Disney?
Yeah, that's crazy. But did you see that people are looking at it already?
Yeah, I heard one of the conversations was with Netflix, but this is a little pricey for Netflix. It had a budget of $170 million.
Oof.
But Andy Serkis and artist Elba were already signed up, and this was supposedly based on the Eisner-winning comic, but it was the sort of the log line was Game of Thrones for mice.
Right.
Supposedly, what Disney told the folks at Fox is like, look, we need you to focus on lower cost family fare. And again, kind of ironic because we were just talking about that with Santa Claus and Noel and how that sort of stuff is going over to Disney Plus. But they were also told that what we need Fox to do is put out movies that are PG and R. So we have a place to put the Deadpool movies. So
right. I mean, I don't know anything about this property, but I think it sounded pretty commercial. So I think it's interesting that they cut it so close.
But you have to wonder, we're sitting here now, it's 3 weeks since Dumbo was released to theaters. So far, that movie has only sold $94 million worth of tickets in North America, which isn't great news. In fact, it's kind of ironic that Dumbo's production costs, oddly enough, Drew, were also $170 million.
Interesting.
So, you know, I'm sorry, I see a little connective tissue there. And overseas, Dumbo is doing better. It's 178 million ticket sales. But when you compare how this Tim Burton film is tracking right now at the box office versus Jon Favreau's Jungle Book, which was pretty much released in the same release window 3 years ago. After 3 weeks in North America, that reboot of a hand-drawn Disney film had sold 263 million worth of tickets, and basically three times the business that the Burton Dumbo has done. That's not great news.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few reasons why this has not performed. I mean, if people like you aren't getting a kick out of it, then that's a problem, clearly. And then I think it has even less resonance with millennials and people who are younger. Like, who's throwing on Dumbo, you know, for a casual watch? Not a lot of people.
True.
But yeah, but it hasn't been a good year for animated movies or animated adjacent movies at all, really.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, if you think about Missing Link, I mean,
Did you go see it?
Yeah. I mean, it's a charmer. It really is. It doesn't, you know, hit me the same way that, say, Kubo or Paranorman did, but it's a beautiful film and got a lot of charm, but just $8 million worth of tickets during its first week?
Yeah.
That's not good. With Travis Knight headed over the hill to go direct the $6 billion man for Warner Brothers, I guess they're doing, the Mark Wahlberg supposed to star in this thing.
Right.
I'd be a little nervous if I were working at Laika.
Yes. It is the lowest, I think the lowest opening weekend for any Laika movie. Mm-hmm. And it's half of what the previous lowest opening was, which was for Kubo. So, yeah, it's not a great number.
It's been a rough year so far for animation. If we look at How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World, that's topped out at $158 million, which is Dragons 2 did $177 million domestically back in 2014, and the original Dragons did $217 million back in 2010, and Lego Movie 2, the second part. Everybody in the industry is like, yeah, we did bad, but look at Wonder Park. Oh, my God. You know, it's like... So, the Hollywood Reporter just did a story about this, that this really isn't an animation problem. Ticket sales in 2019 are currently at a six-year low. A lot of people in the industry are now looking toward Avengers Endgame, Toy Story 4, and Frozen 2 to turn things around. Speaking of Frozen 2, did you see that tweet that Kirsten Anderson Lopez put out 4 days ago?
I was alerted. You know, this might come as a surprise to you, Jim. I'm not hounding Kirsten Anderson Lopez's Twitter account quite like you are.
I'm sorry.
But yeah, you alerted this to me, and it is telling. Should I read what it says?
Sure.
It said, "We made a song where there never was a song today. Idina Menzel is the greatest inspiration and storyteller."
All right, I was working the math here. We're 7 months out from Frozen 2's November 22nd, release date this year.
And what are we even closer to, Jim? D23 Expo. And do you remember when she came out and sang Let It Go months before anyone even knew what Frozen was?
Oh, interesting point.
I'm wondering if they looked at the movie and said, we don't have a Let It Go to unveil to the world in August. We got to get cracking.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting, because there's this wonderful presentation that Kristen and Bobby did just after the Broadway musical version of Frozen opened last year. And
that's your favorite musical, right, Jim?
Oh, yeah, right up there with Cats. In fact, ideally, that's what I'm waiting for the next movie, Snow Cat. Anyway, that they were talking about, the thing is, if you actually take a close look at Let It Go, said, we wrote that song back when Elsa was still the villain of the movie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it's like, it said, if you dig down into that song, there's still a lot of villainous Elsa in there. But again, that's supposedly the song that turned the whole project around. So I guess for me, the fact that, hey, we created a wonderful big new song for Idina Menzel 7 months away from the film being released, it's sort of like, really? I'm a little concerned. But on the other hand, I trust Kristen, I trust Bobby, so I'm sure things will be fine.
A lot of late nights in Burbank over the next few months, I'm sure.
I guess so. Well, speaking of changes, if we pivot now to the DreamWorks Illumination side of the fence.
Right.
Been shifting some release dates around. Croods now. It's now being moved into the release date that Sing 2 had, which it was being released December 23rd, 2020, on the exact same day as Avatar 2, I think. From what happened with Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince and Winnie the Pooh, we know what to call this, Drew. This is called the death slot. Right. I feel kind of bad there. On the other hand, this isn't Chris Sanders and Kirk D'Amico, right? It's I forget who they've got doing Croods.
Kirk was still on it for a little while when Chris left to do Call of the Wild. But yeah, I don't think either. None of them are on it now. But in that press release that talked about the release date changes, they did confirm that Garth Jennings is back to write and direct Sing 2, which I'm very happy about.
Yeah. In a weird sort of way, they've got a bunch of the numbers up on YouTube. And on a tough day, I find myself circling around to Don't You Worry About a Thing.
Right.
It's a wonderful piece of animation and a beautiful version of that song. But
Sing is probably my favorite Illumination movie. If I'm
Is it really?
Yeah, I think so. It's got kind of its own idiosyncratic charm that I really like. Did we talk about... we did talk about the Secret Life of Pets attraction, right?
We did.
But it's very clear that area of Universal Hollywood is going to become an Illumination area. Mm-hmm. And part of me wonders if it was pushed back in time to get something up out of the ground for opening. Because it's interesting that Pets is pushed back. Pets is opening this year, but the attraction isn't opening till next year. So I wonder if, even if it's a stage show or something, that they can get something going by July 2nd, 2021. And that gives them a little bit more of a runway there.
I would love to see that. I would just wonder how you'd pull that off, though.
Yeah.
I
mean, it's clearly one of the big franchises that Illumination is investing in. So, yeah, it'll be really interesting.
Well, now, speaking of big animation franchises for Universal, Trolls has mutated into that as well. I mean, we've got Trolls World Tour coming out April of next year, but I know you talked about going to the Mickey the True original pop-up in November, but I totally missed that in the same window of time on 57th Street, just off of Times Square, they opened the Trolls experience?
Yeah, I had no idea about this until You had just told me about it, yeah.
You get to go into this building where at one point they offer you a troll makeover where you can get the hair. And given that, you know, my forehead goes back about 5 feet now, this sounds very appealing to me. You know, just, you know, go in and see what it, I remember what it was like to have hair.
God knows I'd love to see that, but yeah.
But just this past week they announced that not only do we have this Trolls Experience thing that's supposedly going to travel around the country, but there is now Trolls Live. And it's an arena show that the DreamWorks folks are doing with VStar, which evidently is an arm of Cirque du Soleil.
Really?
Yeah. So it's a 60-city tour. Starts in November this year. In fact, the interesting thing is that when this show goes live on April 22nd, I want to say the very next day, members of the Troll Fan Club can buy tickets in advance. And on the other hand, members of the general public have to wait till May 3rd to get their seat down front to look at Poppy. And
who is a member of the Trolls Fan Club?
There's a whole lot going on in the world, Drew, that I am not aware of.
Oh, my Lord.
On the other hand, I cannot tell you the number of listeners to Fine Tuning who have sent me the video clip from Universal Studios Florida where Troll, Poppy, and the Glitter Troll come out, the walk-around character versions.
Oh, God.
Come out, and at one point, the cast member or the team member at Universal who's wearing the Glitter Troll costume turns around to the people who are waiting to do the photo, meet and greet, autograph opportunity. I'm not entirely sure how he manages to flip his butter, that sort of thing, but a cloud of glitter comes off of his butt cheek. So it's one of these things where it's like, I don't think, you know, having a walk-around character simulate farting glitter, I'm not sure Universal Management signed off on this.
Very creative. Very creative. If that glitter got on me, though, I would be so enraged.
We're gonna transition from trolls to whom the bell tolls. When we get back from our commercial break, we're gonna talk about Disney's Hunchback of Notre Dame. Obviously, the reason we're talking about this film is the tragedy of Notre Dame Cathedral, the fire that consumed this 700-year-old building. It turns out the area that was over the main cathedral, above the ceiling, it's known as the forest. And the thing is, it was filled with dry 700-year-old timber and crates of artifacts. But the interesting thing, if you know Disney's Hunchback of Notre Dame, this is where Quasi lived.
Do you like this movie, Jim?
I actually like this movie quite a bit.
Me too.
It has, I think, one of the very best scores of the second golden age of Disney feature animation. But it has such a weird development history. I mean, do you know who came up with the idea for this movie?
No, I don't.
David Staten, the guy who was eventually the infamous president of Disney Animation. He was the guy who was in charge from 2003 to 2006. He was the one who shut down Feature Animation Florida. He shut down the Paris studio. He was the one who Eisner basically turned to and said, we're making this an all CG operation because we're going head-to-head with Pixar. And
he came up with the Secret Lab, right?
Actually, I think Secret Lab predated him.
Interesting. Okay.
But David basically lost his job because in, what was it, January 2006, Disney bought Pixar and John Lasseter came through the door and started calling the shots. But
David wasn't a guy who was known for his creativity. Let's just say that.
He was not a
Katzenberg kind of character.
The story that he told about Hunchback is that he remembered as a kid reading the classic comic book version of Hunchback and thought, wow, it's this really vivid story, and it really does, in a way, lend itself to animation. But again, he proposes this idea in the early 90s, and when it starts making its way through the development pipeline is right after Beauty and the Beast came within inches of taking Best Picture. For Disney, this was an event that really kind of got people in knots at the company because they were like, we were so close, but we can do it the next time. And you know, which is why Pocahontas went from John Smith and Little Princess Pocahontas being 10 or 12 year old kids to full-grown, handsome adults. And with Hunchback, I mean, Kirk Weiss and Gary Trousdale coming off of Beauty and the Beast. And so it's, all right, we need to make an important movie. What's important? And it's like, well, what about this Victor Hugo novel? And so, what is it, 1993, the development team flies over to Paris, and they actually spend 3 days exploring the Cathedral of Notre Dame, visiting, you know, wandering the hidden stairways and, you know, going behind the scenes and all that and getting a sense, real sense of the world. So they work on some concept art, and they made the trip over to Paris in October. In November, they're sitting down of 93, they're sitting down with Michael Eisner. And it's Dave Goes is standing at the front of the room, making the pitch to all the Disney executives. And 14th century Europe, a dark and dreary time, a time of hopelessness, a time of... And before Dave can continue, Michael Eisner from the back of the room is like, Euro Disney! You know, which was much funnier then, because this was when Euro Disney was circling the bull. You know, they were having to make all these deals with bankers to try to keep the place afloat. So it was kind of like, oh, okay, you have a sense of humor about this. Good, Michael. But Michael, for some reason, fell in love with this material. In fact, I think you and I are both fascinated, Drew, by the idea that this is supposedly Michael Eisner's favorite Disney animated film.
Yes. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, he was the one that kind of pushed along the German stage production, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That one popped up in 1999. Completely German. You can chase down the soundtrack today. It's very different from the version of Hunchback that's now being done on stage. That debuted at the La Jolla Playhouse back in 2014 and is now done more as a choral piece. And I mean, with a full chorus of 40 people on stage, and the performers step in and out of the chorus to become Quasimodo and Esmeralda and Phoebus and Frollo and all that. But the characters you won't see step out from the new stage show, though, are the gargoyles, which were in the German version of the show, but they were wildly controversial from day one.
Really?
Well, initially the idea was it wasn't three gargoyles, it was just two. Quasi was up in the bell tower, and he had his two friends, Bella and Boris, as in Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi.
Right.
And so Bella was going to be sort of the crude, you know, you must go down, you must, you know, where Boris was going to be the more thoughtful one. Oh, Quasi, not to think about this. But over time, it was sort of like, it's a little on the nose. And so they then started going, well, what if he had a trio of gargoyles he was dealing with? And at that point, they were Lon, Charles, and Quinn. And the names came from the three actors who had played Quasimodo in live-action films. They had, that was Lon Chaney, Charles Laughton, and Anthony Quinn. And you reminded me, you know, as they were, you know, working on the film for a long time, the voice of the character that was initially called Quinn, the female, was voiced by Cyndi Lauper.
Yes.
They thought, you know, having a cute little female voice and kind of quirky, because Cyndi coming off of Girls Just Want to Have Fun. And, you know, so they were kind of looking for that off-the-wall kind of persona for Quinn. And it never quite worked the way they wanted. And I'm told that when Kirk and Gary went to Cyndi and told her that, you know, they were going to have to recast, that it just would work, she was heartbroken.
Right.
She'd always wanted to be part of a Disney animated feature. But remember, the upside of this is that Cyndi Lauper has since reinvented herself as a Broadway composer. In fact, didn't she take home the Tony for the song she wrote for Kinky Boots?
For Kinky Boots.
What Disney wound up doing was they then decided to flip Quinn to an older woman. And that's when they reached out to character actress Mary Wicks, very first actress to play Mary Poppins.
Really?
Yep. I want to say it was for CBS and an hour-long television adaptation of the Peale Travers story. But yep, first Mary Poppins. But then by then, the whole thinking at Disney was like, this Lon, Quinn, Charles thing, that's great for film buffs, but it's going to mean nothing for people actually watching the movie, for the regular movie-going public. That's when the male gargoyles became Victor and Hugo, paying tribute to the author of the book. And Laverne actually came from the Andrew sisters, because the Andrew sisters were Patty, Maxine, and Laverne. And, well, if there's going to be three of them, the third one's going to be Laverne. Now, the big question, Drew, what are your thoughts on a guy like you?
I like it. I think it's great. Do you not like it?
No. In fact, I love this number from the film.
Is there a controversy around it?
Actually, a lot of controversy.
Really? In fact,
doubling back to us being concerned about Kristen and Bobby writing a new song for Frozen 2 7 months out, they were doing test screenings of Hunchback, and they would get to that sequence where Quasi's up in the tower and he's about to have his heart broken by Esmeralda and Phoebus, and it was so dark, it was so sad. They were like, we need to do something here to lighten the mood. And this was the last number written for the movie, and it was like, go crazy. And they did. In that sequence, you can see it was an image that went through the entire production process, but they could never figure out how to put it in the movie. It was going to be Hunchback of Notre Dame's Little Simba putting his paw in Mufasa's footprint. You know, the image that sort of summed up the whole movie.
What was it?
You know how when there's a moment when he's looking around and you see Quasi's looking around at the bells in the belfry and you see his image distorted?
Yes.
There was originally a scene in the Court of Miracles where in order when Phoebus and Quasi broke in, the way they were going to guarantee that Phoebus and Quasi were not going to reveal to Frollo where the location of the Court of Miracles was, where all the thieves of Paris gather, they were forcing Phoebus to marry Esmeralda. You can actually see a callback to this very, very late in the movie. Literally in like the last 5 minutes of the film, there's a moment where you see Phoebus is happy that Esmeralda is alive, and so is Esmeralda, and so they embrace, and then they stand back, and Quasi steps up and puts his hands over their hands?
Yes, I remember that moment, sure.
Okay, that was supposed to be, Quasi was supposed to be Phoebus's best man at the wedding in the Court of Thieves. When it came time to seal the marriage, Quasi was supposed to put both of his hands on top of Esmeralda and Phoebus's hands, but before that he was supposed to give a toast. And so he picks up a chalice. His heart is broken because, of course, he loves Esmeralda. He wants to marry this beautiful gypsy. But, you know, Phoebus is being forced to do this. And he picks up a chalice and he looks in the chalice. And because of the curve of the chalice, his face is distorted. And you see there he is, you know, there's a reflection back as a normal human being.
Oh, interesting.
He's not deformed. He's handsome. And it's like, how cruel to be forced to give away his love and to see, you know, what might have been. And again, this was one of these things where through all of the versions of the movie, everyone agreed, oh my God, that's ridiculously moving. And we have to find a place to put that in. But the Court of Miracles scene never worked the way that it was supposed to. There was a huge love song there called As Long As There's a Moon, which, by the way, made it back into the stage show. In the end, Hunchback, you know, Eisner loves it, so we have to support it. But the PR team are like, how the hell do we sell this movie?
Yeah.
Do you remember the posters? They joined the party, you know, where it showed this conga line of the characters where at the tail end, here's Frollo sort of looking on disapproving, but he's still in the conga line.
Right. Not exactly the movie that it wound up being.
And then when you think about where they held the premiere, you know, where they had the big street party in New Orleans and then had that huge screening for tens of thousands of people inside of the Superdome, which you may recall from Hurricane Katrina.
I'm obsessed with the big premieres from that period. The Pocahontas in Central Park, the Hercules in New York, all those are so fascinating to me.
You then talk to the poor guys who worked at Feature Animation Florida, who the entire time they're working on Mulan, it's like, oh, and they'd been clued in. Well, you know, we're thinking about holding this one in San Francisco. We'll take over all of Chinatown. We'll have an amazing parade there. And by the time Mulan was ready to launch, you know, and they'd had, you know, the box office fell off from Lion King to Pocahontas to a Hunchback to Hercules. By the time Mulan was teeing up, it's like, we're going to just hold this at the Hollywood Bowl, guys. Okay.
Still, that's still pretty good, you know, but yeah.
I think overall, Drew, this movie, I think, has aged well. The one thing I think that stands out in a bad way is the CG crowd stuff.
Yeah, I agree.
And I know going into Hercules, they did some more CG and the next generation of the crowd stuff. And it's not quite as bad, but you watch it today and your eye does get pulled.
Well, the other thing that after you and Lynn were talking about Atlantis and the proposed submarine attraction, I went back and started watching this hour and a half long documentary that you can find on YouTube. I'm not sure if it was on one of the home video releases, but it's a feature length making of documentary about Atlantis. And you can tell that those two guys were so drained by the process of doing Beauty and the Beast and Hunchback back to back that they wanted to have some fun. Little did they know that Atlantis would be just as much of a pain in the ass, if not more so, than anything that came before it. But we can save that for another episode.
No, I mean, Atlantis in a lot of ways is a heartbreaker because it's like, I mean, there's a great making of book of that where it's filled with Mike Mignola's concept art for it.
Oh, yeah. Did I ever tell you when I called him up and started and talked to him about it?
No, really.
Yeah. I called him. It was when I was working at Disney and I did a whole article about it. And he told me, which I couldn't include in the article, he said there was a guy at Disney whose only job was to come up with elaborate deaths for characters. that was the kind of movie that this was at one point. It just breaks my heart because that movie had that kind of grit taken away from it and is now kind of an innocuous movie. But I mean, I still like Atlantis. I just wonder what could have been had they actually done the real Harryhausen-y version that they wanted to do.
Oh, God, yeah. And that one monster you get in the montage when they're underground and making their way to Atlantis, there were, what, four of those? One for, what, all of the four points of the compass? And
right.
You know, no, just a heartbreaker. But circling back to Hunchback, again, Disney thought they had a huge hit. You were talking about how you loved the Hunchback store in Fantasyland, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating to me to think that there was an entire store, permanent store, for, what, at least 6 months that was just Hunchback stuff.
Yep.
I mean, that's crazy.
All right. Well, anyway, Mission Impossible, that's cheery, right?
That's cheery. We've got some great guests coming up that I can't talk about yet, but we were just at the home of a certain Oscar winner yesterday. I'll tell you off the air, Jim. And so we have a lot of great episodes coming up. And yeah, I think you'll really like it. So light the fuse. I was also on that panel at Celebration that you could not attend, which is now up on Coffee with Kenobi. So you can listen to me crack wise.
By the way, I have heard from so many people that you stole that panel.
I doubt that you heard that from any person, but no, I appreciate you.
I have heard from multiple people that in classic Drew Taylor fashion, you drove it straight into the rocks. So
yes.
Really looking forward to hearing this. Speaking of Mission Impossible, though, did you see that? Is it at the New York? Is it the Met? Or
it's at the Museum of Moving Image. Yeah, they're showing all six, including the first five on 35mm. For like $35 or something. It's part of an action movie retrospective. And if we could fly across country and do it, we would. We actually just saw a 35mm print of Fallout in Los Angeles, one of two prints they ever struck of Fallout in 35mm a couple of weeks ago. So if that is any indication, I mean, to see the original movie again on the big screen, it would just be amazing. So yeah, check that out.
All right, on our side of the fence, folks, let's see, we got Disney Dish with Len Testo. We got the podcast I Want That with Michelle Valladolid. We've got Universal Joint with Dustin Fuse. And, of course, the Marvelous Disney podcast. And let's not forget about Looking at Lucasfilm, where, again, just recorded that last night with Dan Zaheer, and he was singing your praises, Drew. Loved hanging out with you in Chicago.
Oh. So great.
Head on over to iTunes and rate and recommend those shows and subscribe to Bandcamp. That's it for now, and we'll be back soon, folks. Till then, take care.
Be sure to tune in again for another fine episode of Fine Tuning. with Jim Hill and Drew Taylor.